Hi, this is Bernie Wides, the naturalist, on the air again with another terrific show. And my special guest today again is Carol Butler, one of my favorite people. And she's an author of many books. And we're going to talk about today mimicry. But before we talk about mimicry, I'll tell you that our sponsor today is Fairway Markets. And, you know, a lot of other markets should be mimics of Fairway.
That's for sure. It's the best.
Because it's one of the best markets in the city. Okay, so we're going to cover the topic of mimicry, which a lot is done by many animals, and that includes insects and birds. Remember, they're all animals, okay? In the Linnaeus system of Animalia. Did I say that right, Carol? Animalia? Or Animalia? I don't know. Okay, what's the difference?
So Animalia.
Yeah. Anyhow, so Carol's going to start this discussion off about mimicry with the two major kinds of mimicry.
Well, actually, there's many more than two, which is what makes this, which is why it's so interesting. Mm. But the ones people are familiar with are Mullerian mimicry and Batesian mimicry, which I'll tell briefly about. There are basically at least five strategies that involve deception of some sort, with the goal, of course, of deterring a predator. So there's concealment, right? Cryptic coloration, so that the predator doesn't notice the potential prey. There's the opposite, the display of warning colorations, aposematic coloration. There is masquerading as an inedible object. We'll talk more about that later if we have time, so that the predator will detect the insect or the animal, but will assume it's an inedible object and will not bother it. And then there's also aggressive mimicry, in which a predator mimics the food of its prey and lures the prey towards it. That the famous one is the anglerfish, which has the antenna right, with a little thing dangling, which looks like food to a prey, and the fish comes to approaches the predator actually, and gets eaten.
Yes, I spoke about that on my show on the anglerfish, and that's a deep ocean fish, and I think the picture of it is still on the photo gallery.
Ah, very good.
It's the one with the huge needle-like teeth.
Right.
Because he's operating in the dark, he gets one shot at the food.
That's right.
He doesn't get it then.
Isn't there some glow or some
yes,
phosphorescence?
Yes, there's
on
a bioluminescence
right,
in it because there are bacteria living in this globe on the front of its head, and they produce the light for him.
So it's very attractive.
Right.
Okay. Mullerian mimicry was thought up by Fritz Müller, or at least he gets the credit for it. He was in the latter half of the 1800s, and Mullerian mimicry, that theory is describes that unpalatable prey that are not closely related display the same warning signal, so they share the cost of educating the common predator, right? So, like with the monarch and the viceroy, both are toxic, although at one point they thought the viceroy wasn't toxic, but we know that it's actually more toxic than the monarch.
So is it now Mullerian?
That makes it Mullerian, that they're not related, but they're both unpalatable and share the same warning signal. And educating the predator in the butterfly world, and probably in all animals, but certainly we know for sure in butterflies, what it does is it makes the predator sick to its stomach,
mm-hmm.
It makes the predator vomit. It doesn't kill the predator, because if you killed the predator, there wouldn't be a lesson to be learned. So the lesson is, if you eat this thing, it's going to make you feel awful, so don't eat anything that looks like that.
Right.
That's mimicry. That's mm-hmm. that type of mimicry. Then Batesian mimicry was explained in 1862 by Bates, based on his observations. He traveled in the Amazon jungle for 11 years, collected 14,000 14,000 species, and part of the time he traveled with Alfred Russel Wallace, who was a contemporary of Darwin's and who came up with the theory of natural selection around the same time as Darwin did, and really his publications and that natural selection was in the air really pressured Darwin to write about natural selection, which he was hesitant to do because he didn't want to be criticized because it was so anti-religious and it sort of was anti-creationist. So Bates traveled with Wallace, and a Batesian mimic is an animal that is not toxic, but that evolves to copy a warning signal, like a warning coloring, from a dangerous species that advertises its danger, usually toxicity, with its color. So predators learn to avoid the coloring. The mimic deceives the predators into thinking that it also is toxic, although it isn't.
Right.
And I will upload some photographs of butterflies where we have the model and the mimic, and these are Batesians, where the mimic is not toxic. So very interesting.
Right. And good. That's a good introduction, Carol. Right.
And Bernie has uncovered, I don't know what you want to say, but he has uncovered the most fantastic species that is a multiple mimic. It's really quite amazing.
Right. Very versatile, this critter.
Yeah, right.
So I'm going to talk about that critter now.
Yeah.
And it's called Dynamic Mimicry in an Indo-Malaysian Octopus. So we're going to talk about this octopus, and you know, an octopus is a cephalopod, and the other creatures that are cephalopods are squids. You know, they have the same kind of arms. I don't know. I think they're called arms, but the name octopus means legs. But some people call them arms and legs, eight legs or arms or whatever you want to call it. The nautilus, which lives in the shell, this beautiful, beautiful shell, which also has arms or legs, and the cuttlefish. The cuttlefish most people don't know about because we don't really eat them in this country, but I was in Vietnam a couple of years ago, and they were raising cuttlefish as a food supply, and they're a beautiful but strange-looking animal, maybe we'll do a show on the cuttlefish one of these days, because believe it or not, they were also used years ago in the making of jewelry, and you may say, well, what does this have to do with jewelry? But someday we'll get into that.
Well, and if you have birds, you use a cuttlefish bone
in
the bird cage for the bird to hone its beak on.
Right, that's right. That's right about birds. Well, that bone is the only bone in its body.
It's a big flat rectangular
big flat
bone.
Thing.
Yeah.
And when I was making jewelry and teaching jewelry, that bone is very soft. So what we used to do is we would cut it in half. Okay, lengthwise, and it would flatten out like two pieces of bread, and then we would make a model of a ring or something out of wood, carve it out of wood or out of anything, and press it into the cuttlefish bone, which would leave an impression of the ring, put the other half on, so now you have a mold.
Wow.
And take out the model, and then you tie this together, and then you pour silver into it, and it becomes a casting medium.
I didn't realize it was so soft.
It's soft. You could press it in with your finger and make an impression on it. The outside cover of the bone is not soft. It's the inside that when you cut it open, it's very, it looks like a sponge.
Okay, porous.
Okay, porous. Yeah. But it's rigid. So when you press something in to make an impression of it, it stays that way. That's a very simple way of doing casting that I learned in school.
All
when
right.
I was
I'm babysitting for a parakeet in a couple of weeks, and it has a cuttlefish bone in there. I'm now going to press it because I always thought it was firmer. Maybe it's dried when they use it for the bird cage.
Well, it's probably in the same situation.
I'll let you know.
Okay. So anyhow, let's get back to the octopus.
Yes.
Now, as everybody knows, pretty much, octopuses are an animal that lives in the sea, and there are many varieties of them. And of all of they're invertebrates, and by now we know an invertebrate is a critter that doesn't have an internal skeleton like we do. They have, in the case of the octopus, they have hardly any skeleton at all. They just have a very, very simple little structure in their body to keep them from being crushed and mashed and all that stuff. So they can squeeze and change their body form into many, many shapes in many places. And that's the secret of survival for this octopus. So I have this report from a British Australian team that went to Bali, Indonesia, to do research. So what they did was they took many dives over a 24-hour period, and which revealed that the mime, they called it the mime octopus, emerges during the daylight hours to forage on sand substrate in full view of pelagic fish predators. So most octopuses hunt at night because it's safer for them at night. There are less predators around. But this one hunts during the daytime, which is unusual, first of all. So I'm going to tell you about, I'll give you an introduction to this now, as this article says. Camouflage and mimicry are well documented in cephalopods. So remember the class of animal that they are cephalopods. And come to think of it, I don't think they're invertebrates. I said they were invertebrates, but they're not. But I'd have to look that up because they're sort of in the middle there. They have a rudimentary skeleton, but it's not really a skeleton because you can mash them with your hand and you know it won't kill them. Okay. Up until now, no cephalopod was known to impersonate poisonous or distasteful animals. Furthermore, no animal of any group has previously been described that is able to switch back and forth between mimicry of different model organisms. And as Carol said, the model organism is the organism that the animal wants to mimic.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
Okay. The mimic octopus has an arm span of up to 60 centimeters, and that's about 2 feet, and was discovered in the 1998 off the coast of Sulawesi in Indonesia. It appears to be restricted to the Indonesian archipelago. Archipelago is a chain of islands. And a formal description is currently in process. So these guys have been working on description and classification of this animal for a long time. It is found on silt and sand substrate. The substrate is the bottom. Off river mouths and water between 2 meters and 12 meters deep. So a meter, you know, is about 3 feet. And so 12 meters would be 12 times 3, and that's the depth that they operate on. This habitat is rich in benthic infauna. See, they're using all the scientific stuff, so I'll translate for you. Okay, benthic means open ocean creatures, and infauna means in the sand in the bottom.
Right, bottom dwelling.
Bottom dwelling in the sand. Right. They burrow holes in the sand. And all that, so they're called infauna. With a high activity of worms, echinoderms, which are like starfish, crustaceans, and fishes, riddling the seafloor with burrows, tunnels, and mounds. So this is where these octopuses live, because they burrow down, too, to make a hiding place for themselves.
And are they only found in this one area?
So far, that's only in, they've found it in here. So they're probably going to name it the Indo-Malaysian octopus.
Just because they're so varied, it's interesting that they're in one region.
Yeah, and they say in this study, they may be in other places, but nobody has found them yet.
So they've seen all this behavior, which you are yet to describe, in this one region.
In this one area. Okay. So during daylight dives off the northern coast of Sulawesi and Bali, we observed 9 adult mimic octopuses over a total of 16 days. And still photographs and over 6 hours of video footage were obtained. And what I want you to do when I'm finished talking is go to the photo gallery, and you'll see these fantastic pictures of these octopuses doing their mimicking thing. And in figure one, which I'm going to go over these figures because you can probably remember these. And I was going to ask Jack if he can show the pictures at the same time as the show is on, so I don't know if he can do it. Figure one shows still images of various behaviors and their proposed mimicry models. These are intended to give an indication of the body postures associated with the behaviors we are describing, but can't really convey the movements that are the most convincing aspect of these displays. Mm. So these guys made videotape out of it too, but right now we don't have the facility to do that here. I'll see if I can find out where you can see that videotape.
But even in the still photographs, I'm looking at the prints of the still photographs that you brought along.
Right.
And you can see pretty clearly how they're mimicking the model.
Yeah, so the first picture shows them. The first octopus were typically encountered sitting on the mouth of their burrows on sand or stilt mounds. And when they're sitting on the mounds, they look like a cone shape with all their legs retracted and just their the siphon, which they take water in, and the head showing, so they can look around like a lookout for predators. Okay, and then in figure 1B shows them foraging, or typically crawling along the substrate in drab brown colors.
And there they look like what we normally think of as an octopus.
Right, they're crawling along on the substrate, and they assume the colors of the sand, because in that photograph you can almost see that. That they're the same color as the sand. So there's a form of camouflage. Or
right.
Is that word crispus? Crispus or I never remember that word. It means
crypsis.
Crypsis, hiding.
Right.
Cryptic or hidden.
Cryptic coloration. Yeah.
And they use their arms to probe down holes, and the flared web to trap fleeing prey. So what they do is they crawl along on the bottom. If they come across a wormhole, they'll stick one of their arms down into the wormhole to try and grab the worm and pull it out. And you know they have these suction discs on their body, which are very powerful. So if there is a worm, they can sort of get it right up and into their mouth. When moving faster using jet propulsion, you know, they can move along the bottom with jet propulsion. What they do is they take water into their body and they shoot it out the back of the body, which moves them along, just like a jet plane does the same thing. That's why it's called a jet propulsion. When moving faster using jet propulsion, the octopus draws all its arms into a leaf-shaped wedge with a central mantle trailing the head. This is figure 1C. And in this form, it swims between the worm mounds, undulating the body in the fashion of a swimming flatfish. Hmm. So you all know what flatfishes are. They're flounders.
It's like a flounder.
And
yeah.
Sole. And if you go fishing, fluke, or summer flounder, or fluke, and they're flatfish. So they swim, they look like a doormat when they're swimming.
Right.
And in fact, big fluke are called doormats if you catch them. And with one eye, with both eyes facing up.
Right.
And that's another story about those flatfishes,
right,
how they get those eyes facing up.
But you can see, again, you can see in the image how the octopus has its legs trailing behind it and close to the body, so that if you imagine what a flounder looks like, I can imagine having caught flounders on Long Island Sound, that it really looks like a flat fish in the shape of a flounder with some incidental arms trailing out in the back.
Right, but basically it has the form of the flatfish, which is really amazing because, you know, some of the critters that they're trying to fool, they would see the shape and they wouldn't look to investigate. They just wouldn't go near it.
Right.
Okay? Okay, so why do they want to impersonate this flatfish? Because this fish has poison glands near its fins.
Okay, so it's obviously not a flounder. There's some kind of a flatfish.
It's a sole. It's called a sole.
In that region, there's a toxic sole that they're imitating.
Yeah, the ones we used to catch in Long Island, but they had no toxic glands in them. But this one does. So here's a case of, would that be Mullerian mimicry?
That's Batesian.
Batesian, okay. So it's
one is a mimic that's not toxic, and it's mimicking a toxic model.
Right, so it's mimicking this toxic fish.
Right.
Okay, and why are they doing that? Because the critters that prey on the octopuses are damselfish that are very territorial.
Mm-hmm.
And if they see an octopus in their territory, they're going to go after it to chase it away,
right,
because the octopus eats the same food that the damselfish eats.
Okay.
Okay, so that's an interesting form. Okay, so we spoke about it imitating a flatfish. Okay, we believe that this unique posture is mimicry of an abundant sole found in this habitat, and the sole is the kind of fish. Okay, and I'll tell you about one more thing before we run out of time. Four individuals were also observed swimming just above the seafloor with arms trailing from the body, taking on the appearance of a lionfish.
Mm. And you also have uploaded, I am looking at the image of that, and I think people know what a lionfish is from looking in saltwater aquaria.
Yes, it looks like the mane of a lion has these fins that are tipped with poison. So here's another case of this octopus, which looks nothing like a lionfish, but is imitating the lionfish, but the way it holds its arms when it's swimming along. Okay, so it has the same coloration of the lionfish. Black and white banding seems to be very common in these critters for coloration. Okay, so I have one of these pictures. So when you get a chance to look at the gallery, you'll see side by side with the lionfish. One is the octopus and the other one is the lionfish. Okay, so figure LE, which I labeled, is the closest image we have of this behavior. On four occasions, attacks by small territorial damselfish elicited a posture where the six arms were threaded down a hole and two were raised in opposite directions.
Wow.
Now it's going to impersonate this next animal, the banded, curled and undulated figure on figure G to produce the appearance of a banded sea snake. Now, the sea snake is a very poisonous snake. It's as poisonous as a rattlesnake. And it's not very big. Maybe it's 2 feet long, and it's very slim, and it's banded, black and white. So the octopus goes to its burrow, its hole, and puts four of its arms down into the hole, and has the two arms spread out in opposite directions, and wiggles the arms like a swimming snake.
It's unbelievable. The picture tells it all. You see this octopus, and there's sort of a bump in the middle where it's all stuffed down in the hole, but it basically, in a quick look, it looks like a snake.
Right. So here's a beautiful example of mimicry. And in this case, they don't really know yet whether this octopus is toxic or not. So we'll assume that it's not toxic because it goes to these great lengths.
It doesn't need to be toxic. Right. Look what it can do. That would be overkill.
Right. The majority of individuals also use general background camouflage patterns in response to certain passing predatory fish. Other distinctive behaviors were observed, including sitting atop of the sand mounds and raising all arms above the body, each arm being held in a zigzag form. Mm-hmm. Now, why would they want to do this? It is possible that this posture impersonates large solitary sand anemones that are armed with powerful stinging cells, or called nematocytes. Now, if you remember the story of Nemo, which was an anemone clownfish,
right.
And the anemones are poisonous. But they're not poisonous to the clownfish because they've worked out this great relationship. But the anemone protects the clownfish because nobody goes near the anemone because it's toxic. So here's this probably non-toxic octopus mimicking an anemone and to keep the predator away from him, from being harassed. Okay, and in another incident, a large female, arm span 60 centimeters, which is about 2 feet, swam to the sea surface from 4 meters deep and then slowly sank with undulating arms spread evenly around the animal. This behavior may impersonate a large jellyfish found in the region.
God.
So here we go about all this impersonation. Now, this is very unusual stuff. That's why I'm reading to you. And you'll be the first in your neighborhood to know this.
Absolutely.
This stuff. Because normal mimicry, like I say, like the butterflies, it's much simpler.
But they have one form
of
mimicry,
So it's not dynamic mimicry.
Right.
This is dynamic mimicry because they can impersonate all these different critters. Okay?
This is amazing.
It's
really amazing.
Yeah. So I'll read a little more from these guys had this report, and then we'll stop for a minute. All individuals were observed displaying more than one of the above behaviors. Mm. Human interpretations of potential mimicry are subjective, and at this stage, we are only confident in our interpretation of the mimicry of soles, that kind of flatfish, lionfish, which I told you have the poison spines, and banded sea snakes. Two individuals were observed enjoying all three of these forms of mimicry.
That's amazing.
That means they can change and do it. Mm. So we don't know if it's their brain that really does this. They must have some kind of a coordination in their nervous system so they can do it. And remember that octopuses are probably the smartest of these critters that live in the sea.
Right. They're relatively intelligent.
Really, okay. Unique foraging behavior was also observed in addition to typical speculative foraging. That means hunting, foraging. What they would do is they would thread their long arms down burrows and holes to seize fish and crustacean prey. So what they can do is they can put their arms into these little burrow holes of the worms and crustaceans. You know, crustaceans are little crabs and stuff. And the animals were also observed to enter a tunnel completely and to emerge from the other hole up to 1 meter from the entrance point. We are unaware of any other octopuses that forage through subterranean tunnels. So these critters are really amazing. And when you talk about quick change artists and responses to environment, this is really amazing. And in evolutionary terms, it probably is a form of coevolution,
right,
where they want to occupy this habitat, which is open sand, which is very dangerous for a critter like an octopus because they can't swim as fast as a squid can. Squids are very fast swimmers. Octopuses can swim fairly fast for short distances. And also, you know, they have to protect themselves by changing to the color of the sand.
Right.
But a lot of critters do that. Even fish do that.
Right.
They can change their color patterns on their skin. But to assume the shapes of these different animals is really amazing.
Well, it's also, I mean, makes you wonder what else is out there.
Right.
This is in relatively shallow water off Bali in a beautiful place to do research.
Yes. Have you been to Bali?
So I haven't.
Oh, I've been there. It's a great place to go.
But it's the kind of thing that this is wonderful to study because of the circumstances, right? There's a lot of research that's done on accessible species in pleasant, beautiful places. But you wonder what else is out there in a place that you can't reach so easily that's even more versatile than this octopus.
Yeah. So I'm going to stop for a minute now. And then when we come back, I'm going to talk some more about these amazing creatures. And when I stop, if you can switch now to the photo gallery while we take a break, take a quick look, and then come right back because I'm going to continue the show.
Right.
Okay, so that's it. Okay, we're back on the air again, the Radio Heritage Network, or Heritage Radio Network, and the program's The Naturalist, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about these amazing octopuses, which they didn't have a scientific name for these critters yet, so I think they're still working on the research of these scientists who are from Australia, but from the way they wrote this paper, I'm sure they had their education in England, because there's a lot of English stuff.
Who are the authors? I mean, we should be able to look this paper up because this is really interesting. Maybe
yes,
if you just give the names or the citation.
The author has an email thing, and I'm going to write to him and ask him about the research that they've done. But
but just if the title of the paper, then we can Google it.
The paper, if anybody wants to Google it, it's called The Dynamic Mimicry in an Indo-Malaysian Octopus, and it's the Royal Society, which is an English society. And the authors are Mark Norman, Julian Finn, that's great for a guy doing research on critters in the ocean, and Tom Tregazana.
All right. Okay. If you just Google the title, it'll come up. What say the title once more?
It is Dynamic Mimicry in an Indo-Malaysian Octopus.
Okay.
And I think I'm going to write to him and ask him what the name is
that they gave this
critter, because they didn't, in this article, they didn't have a scientific name for it yet. And ask him if the video is available, because I really would love to see that.
Yeah, that would be wonderful to see.
So another point is that, this is called dynamic mimicry because they can change. Most mimics, like a butterfly, has the colors to mimic another butterfly, but they can't change to mimic another critter.
Right.
Once they have their colors, that's their colors for life. Right, Carol? They can't really
The only change, and that's one of the other interesting elements of it, is how do they become mimics, right? If they originally were neutral colored or cryptic, and then they evolved to become a mimic.
That's how they did it.
They evolved to become a mimic, right. And it raises an interesting question, which is, you know, another subject for discussion. How did the intermediate stages, the intermediate phenotypes are transitioning, how did they not get all eaten? Because they're given up being cryptic, and they're not evolved yet to become a model with a warning coloration or whatever they're mimicking. Mm-hmm. So that, how do they survive in that intermediate stage? One theory, at least from some little bit of research that was done on snakes, is that when in the intermediate stage, when there are a lot of models around, the mimic doesn't get attacked as much because they sort of resemble the model, and that's enough. When there's a very dense population of models, the predators stay away. But this is a whole nother subject. Let's talk about the octopuses.
Okay, so one reason that the octopus can do this is because the kind of body it has, okay, which is very, very flexible and elastic, you might say. And it doesn't have, as I said, it doesn't have an internal skeleton, and it doesn't have an external skeleton.
You really have to look it up, because I don't know the answer to that.
So the classification is a cephalopod. Maybe that name, I'll have to check that and see if that means, I don't know, mushy body.
Because you can eat an octopus. You don't have to take it out of a shell.
No.
So if it has an exoskeleton, it's very soft. And they're so fluid.
They don't have
an internal skeleton that like a fish that you think of.
They just have one central thing in their body. I know that squid have a piece of, it's like cellophane in their body, rigid thing.
I've dissected squid.
And
when you cook them,
when you
have
go fishing,
to take them
when
apart.
You're going to cook them, you take that that pin out. It's called.
Oh, so that's but probably that, the same as a cuttlefish. Yeah,
and the cuttlefish has the cuttlefish bone,
right,
which is a little more rigid than that
so
one.
That's the structure. So it's probably, it's an internal skeleton, but of a very special type.
Yeah, very limited skeleton. I wouldn't call it a skeleton. I don't know. Call it just a central bone or something. Yeah. And also, they think also that this ability to be a dynamic mimic, also is a sexual attractant for the males and the females. They think that the male that has the biggest repertoire probably gets the most ladies.
Makes sense.
Sense. What do you think, Carol?
Absolutely.
Best repertoire?
Right.
Okay. Also, I was thinking about positions.
Right.
But we won't go into that. All these different positions that these octopuses can get into. It might be interesting if he does a display during courtship.
That's right.
Of the different positions. Okay, so I think we spoke enough about this octopus. Even there's much more to talk about in relation to evolution. This is sophisticated behavior, and remember we're talking about not a primitive animal, but certainly much lower down on the evolutionary scale than mammal behavior.
Well. But sounds pretty high to me.
It's pretty high up, right. So they also can match their backgrounds, which
many species of octopus are known for doing that.
Yeah, so the people who wrote this said it's a puzzle why people haven't found other cephalopods that can do the same thing.
I'm telling you, they're in deeper water, and it's not off valley.
They may be night critters, too.
Right, yes.
And these critters were active during the daylight because they could do it. And The major reason that they're doing all this is because, I think I said before, there's this fish called the damselfish, which is a reef fish, and it's very protective of its environment. So if any critter comes into the damselfish's location, the damselfish will attack it.
And they're competing for food in the territory.
They're competing for the same food supply, worms and other infauna, benthic critters. So they say in this report that there's more research to be done.
Right.
So I'm going to stop talking about them. Now, if anybody out there in our audience has more information about this octopus, I would be glad to have it. And maybe in a subsequent program, I'll try to do more research on it and find out more about if they found any other critters that can do this amazing stuff. So, Carol, you had something you wanted to talk about to add to mimicry.
It's just interesting. There's a lot of variation in mimicry. For example, the toxicity can vary in a species, right? Based on the time of year and the resources that they have. Animals, I know most about butterflies, but they gain their toxicity from their diet. So if they're eating a toxic plant, they're storing up the toxins, and that gives them a defense. But if it, in some species, butterflies are very fussy about what they eat in general, but in other species, if they're like bees, where they're much more flexible, if they don't have the toxic food source, they might choose another food source that isn't toxic, and then their toxicity is less of a defense. But you would think, so what that means is, depending on the time of year and the environmental resources, an animal can be a malarian mimic to one predator and a Batesian mimic at another time or to another predator, right? So to one it can be toxic, to one it isn't.
Right, and these guys stress that it's not rigid, these categories. Right. There's overlap.
Right.
And maybe some of them at one time are one and then another.
That's right.
Yeah.
And what's also interesting is you would think that mimics should always be in the same habitat as their models, right? Because if there aren't any models present, the protection should break down, and there's nothing to warn a predator off. Predators won't recognize them as dangerous, and especially if they're mimics in terms of coloration, they're now colorful rather than camouflaged, so predation would be more intense.
Mm-hmm.
There is some research that has found mimics where they're, and they've done some research presenting them to predators where there's no model, where they haven't been exposed to a model, and in fact they will attack the mimic mm-hmm. because they have no reason to be afraid of it. However, the distribution usually, it always overlaps, but there can be situations where the mimic exists in time when there isn't a model.
Remember, the model is the critter that they're trying to mimic or impersonate.
Right. There's almost always some overlap. But for example, some coral snake mimics exist hundreds of kilometers outside the range of their models. And so it's an interesting question to just say, how can that be?
Mm.
And part of it is just in transition. If they have been in the same habitat and over time their resources are different, and so there is the type of food that one wants is gone from the habitat, it migrates, and so there's a period of time where they're separate because of circumstances. Sometimes a predator has just a instinctive avoidance of brightly colored potential prey, and it doesn't depend on the model being there.
That's a good subject too. But so is this stuff instinctive, or do they have to experience it?
Right.
You know, because as you said, some of them are instinctually avoid bright colors like reds and oranges and butterflies especially, right?
Right.
So if that's learned behavior, has it been passed down through the genes?
Well, there's some research on that. If I have time, I'll get to it. We have one study where they explored that, about if you hadn't been exposed to the model, how do you react to the mimic? I'll try to get to that. Well, maybe I can, since we don't have much time, let us go straight to that. This is a study where they tried to see if starlings, European starlings, could learn to use a bitter taste to predict the amount of toxin that a prey contained.
Mm.
When they take in a toxic prey, they don't know it's toxic until it's in their stomach, right? Until they're sick from it. So this was a study to see whether they would eat toxic prey if the nutritional gains were high enough to balance out the cost of risking the toxin. So this is very complicated. They manipulated the toxin concentration in mealworms. They got similar length mealworms, and they injected a quinine sulfate solution into the mouth of the mealworms. That kind of solution makes predators vomit. And it's used in learning experiences.
That would make me vomit, I'll
right,
tell you
probably.
That.
Right. Then they manipulated the taste of the prey, right? All the prey is now defended with this toxin, but the starlings would have no way of knowing. And they They coated the mealworms with a solution called Bitrex. And that's associated with a color change. And they use, excuse me, they use 2 drops of the Bitrex, which would create a mildly distasteful mealworm, and 8 drops to create a much more distasteful mealworm. So again, the Bitrex has no toxic effect, but it has a taste, and it has a difference in appearance. So it's associated with the coloring. So you're really teaching the starlings. Right. So the prey was then presented to the caged starlings. Oh, sorry. Okay. They swallow the mealworms whole, and so they don't detect the chemicals until the worm is in the stomach, right? But when the Bitrex was used to predict, that they could use the Bitrex to predict the concentration of quinine in the worm, and so they preferred to eat the ones that were less toxic. Mm. So here, clearly, it was a learned response.
Yeah.
Right? There's another study where they exposed, I downloaded that image on the of a twig of,
oh, yes.
of, a, of right. incredible insect that looks like a twig.
Right, when it's a twig animals.
Right, and they also they showed the predator. I don't have it in front of me, but they showed the animal that's the predator, the twig, the toxic animal that mimics the twig, and another caterpillar that isn't toxic. And when they had seen the toxic animal that mimics the twig, they avoided the caterpillar, even though it may or may not be toxic. They could associate it with the twig.
Good. Okay, we're gonna have to stop. This is a fascinating subject, and it can get very complicated with
all these
different methods of critters protecting themselves between camouflage and mimicry, and all forms of both of them, and
masquerading and all that.
Right. Yeah, and just think about Halloween, putting on your masquerade and so nobody knows who you are, and
well,
all that
we
stuff.
We do it too, subtle ways,
right?
Without costumes, but we have all kinds of ways that we masquerade or hide. So.
Hide our feelings.
Right.
Do. Okay. Right. So we're going to sign off in a minute, and I want to remind you that this is a Heritage Radio Network. The program is The Naturalist. And don't forget to check up on the Museum of Natural History's website, because there's all this great stuff for families and young people and all age groups at all times.
AMNH.org.
That's it. And then you can go /programs, and you'll get whatever you want to know about the museum. And don't forget, we have great exhibits there now. The Silk Road exhibit is great for families. And the Race to the End of the World on Antarctica, which is a terrific exhibit.
And you may find Bernie in there.
That's right. You'll find me in there. Come and say hello. And Snakes and Lizards, which is a live exhibit. And Butterflies will return in October. They've sort of migrated for the summer up to the Bronx Zoo.
To the Bronx Zoo, right.
Which has an exhibit.
The Bronx Zoo opens when we close, and then closes in October when we open.
Yes. So we're signing off, and we're off the air.